Hey folks, welcome to the Battles of the First World War podcast. My apologies in advance for bringing up that master's program with Birmingham University again, but here we are. When I started it last September, I hastily finished the combat side of the Meuse-Argonne campaign and had to put the podcast on the back burner. The podcast will continue to have to remain there, but I'd like to share a few things I have learned in the past few months. As I write this in March 2024, I have to say it's been an incredible learning experience thus far. The Master's in Military History program is incredibly challenging. Every free moment I have is now spent feverishly reading because I am a slow but absorbent reader. But I'm reading really fascinating material on the history of warfare, and I'm being forced to analyze and be much more critical of what I'm taking in. All of this work has actually had a positive effect on my day job, as I feel much more confident in doing deep dive research and analytical projects there. I wonder what it will bring to the podcast when I'm able to put my attention back on it. Which brings me to another thing I've learned. As I said, I wrote the last combat narrative episode for the Meuse-Argonne and went right into my schoolwork. At the time, I thought, well, no big deal. The podcast is done for now, and a part of you has always seen it as a springboard for bigger opportunities. And it indeed has been. But as the weeks and now months have gone by, I've also come to learn that, well, frankly, man, I miss podcasting. Seriously, folks, I do. I suppose that's normal, as you can't just walk away from a hobby you've been doing for a decade at this point. So, in a new side project, I've been lucky to begin reviewing books for HNET. Naturally, I'm going after the World War I titles, so I've got one for you here that AEF scholars and researchers will doubtless enjoy. I'd like to read my review and then read a couple of excerpts from the book to help bring it to life. Here's the review. Pershing's Tankers, Personal Accounts of the AEF Tank Corps in World War I, edited by Lawrence M. Kaplan, is a welcome addition to the Great War and/or American Expeditionary Force Scholars Bookshelf. Putting together a, quote, collection of personal experience reports by U.S. Army Tank Corps officers and men written immediately after World War I, as well as other primary source documents that convey the reminiscences of America's first tankers, end quote. Kaplan has collated and helped round out the formation and early history of the United States Army's Armor Branch. Intended for, quote, readers interested in America's first experience with armored warfare, end quote, as well as to, quote, to present the human side of tank corps operations, end quote. The book is organized in a top-down manner. The reader begins with the 30,000-foot view by reading a summary of the U.S. Army Tank Corps' operations during the Great War, where they are led through the formation of the AEF's Tank Corps and its first units. Senior leadership commentary from the Tank Corps' first commanding officers describe how this new branch of the military was put together with a newly raised engineer regiment and infantry and cavalry officers. The bulk of the book comes next with the sections titled Official Tank Corps Personal Experience Reports and Unofficial Personal Accounts. And it's here we meet the men who took the French-made Renault and British Mark V tanks into the vicious combat of the World War I Western Front's final offensives in 1918. We see the human heart of those machines that lumbered into the firestorms. Officers and men of the 301st, 344th and 345th Tank Battalions bring their experiences to life in their own words. We even get a small measure of the men themselves. 344th member, 2nd Lieutenant Donald Taylor's witty style of writing brings a smile to one's lips as you read him, while 301st Commander Major Roger Harrison's Infantry School report on his experiences displays his professionalism with a well-organized and well-written recounting of his battalion's part in the British Somme offensives of September and October 1918. As Pershing's Tankers is primarily a reference work, the reader has available to them several accounts of the same combat actions by multiple men who were all there. In the unofficial accounts, newspaper and digest articles have been collected to provide more accounts. A Literary Digest article from 1919 has Sergeant Virgil Morgan retell the tale of how his good friend Corporal Harold Roberts sacrificed his own life to save Morgan's. Roberts would be awarded a posthumous Medal of Honor for his action. A report from the Fort Meade Museum by Lieutenant Arthur Snyder recounts the story of the famous Five of Hearts tank's actions in Exermo, France. The usual complaint of where a military history book might be lacking, that of maps, does not fit here. Readers familiar with the American Battle Monuments Commission's maps will see sections of that organization's relevant maps in the appendices, along with maps from AEF Commander General John Pershing's own memoirs. The appendices also contain tables on tank corps organization and orders of battle. Together with Christy Campbell's Band of Brigands, the First Men in Tanks, Tim Gale's French Tanks of the Great War, Development, Tactics, and Operations, and Dale Wilson's Treat 'em Rough, The Birth of American Armor, 1917-20, Pershing's Tankers will add a rich depth of personal accounts and reports on the development and deployment of tanks in the First World War. It is a valuable work of reference for the AEF scholar and interested reader. Dale Wilson himself, who wrote the foreword, perhaps sums it best when he writes that the experiences and stories within are, quote, all neatly compiled for readers, sparing them the laborious search the editor made to bring them together in this volume, end quote. All right, there will be a link to the book so you can get your hands on it after you listen to this. Of especial interest to me in Pershing's Tankers were the accounts from the members of the 301st Tank Battalion, which we have not had a chance to discuss here on the podcast before. The 301st was the third active American tank battalion on the Western Front, and it was equipped with British Mark V heavy tanks. The battalion fought with the U.S. 27th and 30th Divisions, which were a part of the AEF 2nd Corps, lent to the British 4th Army. The infantry and tank doughboys here would serve in the area of the Somme and the Selle Rivers in September and October of 1918. A quick note on the tanks. The 301st was issued a total of 48 tanks, some being the Mark V and the rest being the Mark V Star. The Mark V came with either two 57mm guns and four Hotchkiss 7.7mm machine guns in its male version, or in the female version with six Hotchkiss machine guns. The Mark V Star was the same tank, but several tons heavier, and with a couple of extra machine guns jammed in there. Both the Mark V and the Mark V Star had eight-man crews. Let's let Captain Ralph Clark and 2nd Lieutenant John Logan, both of Company C, 301st Tank Battalion, tell you what it was like to take on the Hindenburg Line. Captain Ralph Clark, quote, after months of training in the schools of the British Tank Corps in England, interesting and necessary, but exasperating to men eager to be at the front, The 301st Battalion Tank Corps finally went into the line in September 1918. Company C relieved the 10th Tank Battalion, British, and took over their remaining tanks, the other companies drawing new tanks of the largest type from the base. For 2 weeks, while they itched to get into action, the tank crews, inordinately proud of having their own buses at last, adjusted and cleaned them to the last degree by day, and at night, listened to the guns and watched the attempts of ubiquitous Bosch planes to come over bent on bombing. They could not yet be told that plans were being evolved for a tremendous smash at the only vulnerable point in the famous Hindenburg Line, a drive the success of which would mean much to the Allies and in which they were to have the honor of leading. Then came the night when 40 heavy tanks crawled out at dark on the beginning of a long trek to the lying up place. Dawn found them just nestling under their camouflage again, while the tired crews literally threw themselves down for what rest they could get before the strenuous night and day to follow. Toward dusk, the tank and platoon commanders were assembled for final instructions and checking up of details, and that never-omitted ceremony of synchronizing watches with the time obtained from headquarters. Shortly before midnight, the actual approach march began, the movement that involves bringing the tanks to the jumping off line just at 0 hour, without lights or noise. An approach march tires all concerned, but it tries the very souls of the officers. Over muddy fields and sunken roads, through barbed wire hedges, across abandoned trenches and shell holes, always without light and noise, and most of the time under the searching fire of the enemy artillery. The company commander, groping for the way 100 yards ahead, has his nerves strained to the point of breaking for fear of losing the way and not arriving in time, or an accident or a chance hit, putting part of his command out of commission. The platoon commanders constantly pass up and down their particular tanks to keep all going well. On foot in front of his tank, its commander guides after the preceding one, his only means of communication with his driver, the frantic waving of a glowing cigarette. The approach marches are much alike, some worse than others, but this first one will never be forgotten. Up ahead, the reconnaissance officers were crawling out in front of the infantry lines, laying the tape that serves as a sure guide over the last and most important 1,000 yards or so. Halfway there, an orderly brought word that Lieutenant McCluskey, while so doing, was badly wounded and his sergeant assistant killed. A bit further on, a bad pocket of gas and smoke seriously threatened further progress, but they were led through somehow, officers frequently removing their masks in order to see if possible, and in several cases going on their hands and knees, coughing and gagging, actually finding the way by feeling the tracks. Company C met its reconnaissance officer, Lieutenant Woods, at the beginning of the tape and arrived at the other end without a casualty. Lieutenant Rosborough, commanding a platoon, jumped into Lieutenant Potter's tank with his two orderlies. This tank drove straight for its objective until, while knocking out machine guns in the outposts of the Hindenburg Line, it received a direct hit, killing 6 of the crew and seriously wounding all the other occupants. Hastily evacuating under heavy fire from close by, the survivors took up position with their Hotchkiss guns in a nearby shell hole. In this scant shelter, Lieutenant Rosborough dressed as well as possible the wounds of the others. Then, although wounded and burned himself, he made the precarious trip back to our infantry to try to get help, while Sergeant Frank J. Williams, Jr., his orderly, also badly wounded, insisted on staying with Lieutenant Potter, who was in a serious condition. Eventually, help reached them and they were removed to hospital, but Lieutenant Rosborough was taken prisoner while crawling along. While being conducted to the rear through a trench, he pushed over one of his guards, hit the other in the eye, scrambled up over the side, and got away. After hiding that night and the next day under his derelict tank, he succeeded in working his way back to a dressing station. Many tanks that day went gallantly on until wrecked by a shell. Not one faltered. Lieutenant McKay, twice wounded at his post, was killed while trying to get out of his tank to be out of the way. His crew evacuated upon receiving a direct hit, several badly wounded. Although they had stood to their guns as long as the tank would run. While in a nearby shell hole under heavy machine gun fire, Private William Burns three times crawled back to the tank to get things for the wounded. Once more dressings, again for a coat. And finally, for the dead officer's gas mask to replace Corporal Hoffar's, destroyed by the shot that wounded him. Lieutenant O'Kane's tank received a hit that wrecked it completely, fatally wounding him and one of his crew. Other tanks shared the same fate, but their crews fared better, although many were wounded, for the Boche had direct observation and concentrated his 77s on the tanks. But all were going straight and did splendid work against the machine guns to the last. Lieutenant Dunning's tank in some way missed being hit for a long time, while it went on across trench after trench, through machine guns and wire, until far behind the German lines it was knocked out. Until after dark, the crew hid nearby, then started an almost hopeless attempt to get back. Seven were taken prisoners, but the lieutenant and Sergeant Rosenhagen, after hours and hours of patient, agonizing crawling and wiggling and waiting, reached the British lines and by the next night reported to the battalion. They were sick from gas and exposure, exhausted, soaked, torn to ribbons by the wire, but related their story and turned in their valuable information. Lieutenant Dunning was decorated with the Military Cross and Sergeant Rosenhagen with the Military Medal of the British. After a few days reorganizing crews and repairing of tanks, the company was ready to go in again, not a whit daunted by their terrific initiation. They were veterans now, and no show would ever hold the interest the first did. The chance came on October 8th when the remaining tanks of Companies A and C combined in one company, led an attack on the village of Brancourt. All went well. All tanks reaching their objectives and returning, wiping out machine gun nests and clearing the village. Lieutenant Holmes had the bad luck to get a bullet square in the eye, but his last words to his driver as he lapsed into unconsciousness were to go right on. Lieutenant Dinsmore's tank succeeded in knocking out by a well-placed shot from its six-pounder, a gun in the church steeple that had harassed the infantry for days. Then, after reaching their objective, it went voluntarily to the assistance of a British unit of the Corps on our right, advancing alone and clearing a wood of Boche guns so that this unit could go on. The Germans were retiring fast by this time, and it kept the officers and crews under a night and day strain keeping up the pace of open warfare. But they did it, and went in again October 17th in an attack on the River Selle. Part of the approach march for this show was a nightmare. For 3 hours, from 1 to 4 a.m., it was necessary to lie in position, engines stopped, nothing possible to do but sit tight while shells burst on all sides. All but a few necessary officers were kept inside the tanks in their gas masks while the platoon commanders wandered from tank to tank, looking in and passing a few casual remarks to keep down the inevitable tendency to panic under inaction. But it was a relief to all when the time came to go on, with only two casualties and one tank disabled. Just before 0 hour, when approaching the starting line, Lieutenant Park's tank burst into flames in full view of the enemy, drawing the fire of a dozen machine guns. But this officer quickly had it turned into a nearby wood, shut down and abandoned before it could betray its mates or furnish a useful target for the artillery. In this action also, Lieutenants Dunning of Company C and Frost of Company A cooperated, After fighting to their limit and refilling Lieutenant Frost's tank with the remaining ammunition and petrol from Lieutenant Dunning's, making a temporary crew out of the volunteers from both so that Frost could go back in and do all the damage he could. Once more, the remaining tanks of the battalion operating as one company participated in an attack on October 23rd. It was a night affair, 0 hour at 1:20 a.m., but in spite of the dark, the tanks did splendid work. Again, Lieutenants Frost and Dunning distinguished themselves. With their allotted jobs done, and done well, they looked around, hungry for a scrap, in conjunction with an infantry officer met in Baswell. A little private show was arranged when the two, with their tanks, led a couple of platoons to a new position of advantage half a mile further on. After this show, there was a 10-day period of reorganization and repairs, when everything was newly adjusted and additional tanks drawn. Then on to Le Quesnoy, recently liberated, from whence the battalion stood ready to go into action the following morning, when the armistice was signed. This brought to an end the longest consecutive period a heavy tank battalion has ever been in the line. Only those who have worked with tanks in the dark and mud can fully appreciate what this means. The days of heavy backbreaking repairing, the heartbreaking treks, the strain of the night approach marches, and yet all performed with a cheerfulness and energy that won the battalion the respect and admiration of the experienced British Tank Corps. Like praise from an older brother, that was not easily won, but meant so much more when won. End quote. And now, Second Lieutenant John Logan. Quote, arriving in France, about the middle of August, the 301st Battalion, U.S. Tank Corps, proceeded immediately to Bermicourt, near the center stores of the British Tank Corps. The battalion had men hand-picked in the States, received 5 months tank training in England, and physically and mentally were in the pink of condition. One private expressed the wish of the entire battalion when he said, "Show me the way to the war that we have come so far to take part in." The British said we were fit, and anyone who knows the British methods will know that our training must have been thorough indeed. Tanks were issued to A and B companies. C Company proceeded to Achier-le-Grand to take over the tanks of the 10th British Battalion. This battalion had just aided the New Zealanders in the capture of Bapaume, and many of the tanks were left on the field where they had conked out. It was up to C Company to get these tanks into shape for the initial battle, where we were to have our baptism of fire. Before going to Achier-le-Grand, the writer had the privilege of taking part as an observer with the 11th British Tank Battalion in the breaking of the famous Drocourt-Queant switch line. The experience was well worthwhile. Two sergeants of the observing party were killed. After leaving the British Battalion, we joined our company at Achier-le-Grand. The particular tank assigned to the writer was in the battlefield where it had been left by the British. It was the famous old Jellicoe, and all it needed was a new engine and several patches for holes in the armor plate. The crew worked eagerly, and soon the tank was in tip-top shape. Our next move was to Manincourt. We had been under shell fire for a few days at Achier-le-Grand, but here Fritz was sending them over at regular intervals, but we were becoming used to it. Lieutenant McKay's tank and the Jellicoe, or rather the Arizona, for the crew had decided to give the big lumbering bus a regular American name, were side by side. Black Sammy, as he was affectionately known by his brother officers, was a Congressional Medal man and had seen service with the Marines all over the world. Little did we think that our first fight would be Sammy's last, and that his would be the supreme sacrifice. Then came one morning that we had all been looking forward to. With orders to be prepared to leave at night, everyone knew his part. Cheering news came with the order that we were going over with the Yanks, the hard-fighting bunch, the 27th Division. A Company was to go over with the 30th Division. We made an all-night march with our tanks, and believe me, a trip to hell is nothing compared to leading over trenches and wire in the black darkness. Arriving at the lying out point, the tanks were camouflaged and everyone turned in for a few hours' sleep, some in the mud and some in the tanks. The writer remembered falling between a box of shells in the engine and being too tired to get up, slept there. Working feverishly at our engine, we were able to put it in shape for the approach march that night. After leading our tanks through much shell fire and gas, we arrived at our jumping off point. We afterwards told a reconnaissance officer jokingly that he was in league with the Germans, for the end of the tape at which we were to jump off had been laid actually within the German lines. The barrage started and we were off. The crew of the Arizona were as cool as could be. The sight of the American doughboys strolling along, for that is exactly how they looked, smoking cigarettes, was enough to put courage in the weakest. In about 3 seconds, though, we couldn't tell where we were. It became very foggy, and we rocked like a ship, for Fritz had put down a barrage and shells were falling very close. We could see the other tanks mopping up the trenches to the left of us, and 4 tanks to the right, which we thought were from our platoon. After fighting alongside of these 4 tanks for a while, we discovered them to be from A Company, so we turned to the left to join our own company. We were lucky to do so, for in a few minutes those 4 tanks ran into a minefield and were blown up. We had just cleared up a trench of Jerry's when our engine went dead. We thought an armor-piercing bullet had fixed us, but after a few minutes cranking, we managed to get a couple of cylinders coughing so that we were able to get the tank into the trench so as to repair the damage. Suddenly, I heard a yell and turned to see a mass of flames shooting from the engine. The whole tank seemed to be on fire. The driver and I tried to get out through the top, but the door stuck, so back through the flames we went. I tried to put the fire out with pyrene, but the fumes made me groggy almost instantly, and but for the fact that Sergeant Hoberts dragged me out, I would have surely been badly burned. We were scarcely outside when a German airplane, flying low, dropped a couple of flares. Just then, business began to pick up, for the shells began to fall all about us, and then a German machine gunner spotted us. The gunner had managed to bring out a couple of machine guns, and we mounted them. There was fighting further down the trench, and I saw an American doughboy bayonet a Bosch as clean as you would like. We found 22 Bosch machine guns in the trench and a couple of anti-tank rifles. The shelling was intense, and I became separated from my crew, with the exception of a sergeant. Everyone was lost in the fog and smoke. Later in the morning, I found Lieutenant Richard A. Park, whose tank had been put out of action. We stayed with some Australians that night and found our battalion next morning. Our losses had been very heavy, but they told us that the Hindenburg Line had been taken. I drew a reserve tank with a new crew, and a week or so later, we went in again at Montbrien. This fight was a picnic, and we evened up for our losses in the first show. On the Selle River, we went over with the 30th Division. It was very foggy, and we were lost for a while. My tank, the O'Hell, was to mop up with 3 others. It sure was fun, for we had good ground to travel on. In Boen, we were obliged to shoot up the houses, for the Bosch machine gunners kept firing from them. Our crew suffered no losses, and we picked up Lieutenant Little's crew, whose tank had been stuck in the river. Those boys from the south are a game lot, and there is one officer that I would like to see again. While we were lost in the fog, I was outside my tank trying to get a map location. He came up while we were studying our map. He was covered with blood and bits of flesh. 2 of his companions had been blown to pieces right beside him with a shell, but it never affected his nerve a bit. We wound up the season at Lekenwa near the Belgian border, for the armistice put an end to the open season on Huns. And here we are at Salty, still with the British, each one with but a single thought. When do we go home? End quote. So there you have it, folks. The book is Pershing's Tankers, Personal Accounts of the AEF Tank Corps in World War I, edited by Lawrence M. Kaplan, and it's one I'm sure you will not want to miss. questions, comments, or concerns, please don't hesitate to contact me at verdunpodcast@gmail.com or get at me on the Twitter at WW1podcast. Check out the BFWWP website, firstworldwarpodcast.com, for some photos, and check out the Battles of the First World War podcast page on the Facebook. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you again soon. Take care.